Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So, I like to divide up, and people have their different ways of dividing up, depending upon their anthropology, but I like to divide up amongst physical things and emotional things and psychological things and spiritual things. And obviously that's not like, four pieces of a pie, because as you notice, there's some overlap. There's always going to be overlap because the lower, as Father James was describing with respect to angelic power, is contained in the higher, right? So the soul possesses the body, right? So bodily things, physical things are going to be resonating through or kind of pulsing through spiritual things, right? Which is the reason for which we can't simply leave them aside or abstract them in silly ways. All right, but I think it can be helpful just to divide amongst physical things and emotional things, psychological things, and spiritual things. And you can see how this cashes out in something simple like forgiveness, for instance. Say that you want to forgive someone. And in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament, let's say that this person has died. Okay, so it's not something that you're necessarily going to work out with them in flesh and kind of living communion in the here and now. But in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament, you say, Lord, I ask for the grace to forgive. I choose to forgive. And then maybe you name the person and say, Jordan, I forgive you. Okay? So that's a spiritual action. All right? You have forgiven. Does that necessarily mean that you will think different thoughts, that you will feel different feelings, and that your body, will be experienced in a different manner? Not necessarily, right? Not necessarily, at least not immediately. You'll probably still have resentful thoughts. You'll probably still have resentful feelings. You'll probably still feel some resentment in your body. But that choice is what matters, all right? We all learned this from Albus Dumbledore's counsel to Harry Potter, right? It's not so much how you feel, it's how you choose. All right, so when we divide up amongst these things, we do so as to gain purchase on what's most important and then what's relatively important by comparison to what's most important. All right, and the point is going to be that demons don't have access to your spiritual life in its intimacy. All right, only God does. Only God does. All right, so what can demons do? Father James made reference to the fact that there are two basic ways in which to speak about place, all right? So as contained in and as exercising power on. So when we think about the activity of the demons or the action of the demons, we think about it typically in terms of their exercising power on. And they can train their sights on you physically and emotionally and psychologically to a certain degree or extent, with a hope that that redounds to your bewilderment spiritually, but again, they don't have access, direct access thereunto. So, physical. Father James made reference to this medieval theory about the manipulation of our sense powers, right? He made reference to our sensus communis, that an angel can be made manifest, right? So too of demons, insofar as they retain the powers of their nature, right? They can exercise some kind of power, as it were, over our bodies, right? Over our physical life. All right. And how exactly that works, we don't know. This is largely the zone of free speculation. And with some things, it's delightful to speculate. I think this is part of the reason for which the theologian thinks, right? He doesn't think so much as a way by which to work out his doubts, but he thinks so as to identify kind of handles on the mystery so that he can lay hold of it, so that he can brace it, so that in articulating it, not merely in his mind, but in reality, in conforming his mind to reality, he finds more places in which for his love to lodge, right? Because this is a silly example, but say you have one of these huge exercise balls, but let's say that this exercise ball is 14 feet high or 14 feet in diameter. How are you going to do anything with that exercise ball? You can kind of nudge it around, but you can't you can't get sufficiently around it to pick it up. I got a decent wingspan, maybe 6'3" or something like that, if it is equivalent to my height. But I wouldn't be able to pick up a big ball 14 feet in diameter, right? But with theological reasoning, what you do is you come to discover that with the eyes of faith, there are handles, right? And you can lay hold, right? Not to control, not to manipulate, but precisely so as to embrace, all right? So this is the real purpose of speculation, not vain or idle musing, right? But as a kind of precondition to love, right? You muse on the beloved, you speculate about the beloved so as to discern features in the beloved which merit your response, which merit your love. But when it comes to the demons, I don't know how fruitful it is to speculate, right? It can be cool to speculate about the angels, but with the demons, less so, because sometimes it's scary, right? And we should have good reason for speculating about things scary. Or as my, today's his birthday actually, as my 4-year-old nephew Peter says, scary. All right, so it seems that angels can make manifest, right? So they can appear in some guise or in some shape or form, right? And that they can perhaps do so by the manipulation of your own sense powers, right? But perhaps you've experienced that, but I suspect that many of you have not. I have not. All right. Where it gets more kind of experientially motivated, or where it gets more experientially urgent, is when we talk then about emotions and thoughts, or the emotional and psychological dimensions. So when we talk about emotions, the language that St. Thomas uses is passions of the soul. All right. That word passions, it signifies that it's something that you suffer, right? It's something that is done unto you. Not in like the, oh, it's done unto me, but in the sense that you're principally receptive. All right. So it's activated by something without, which causes a change within. And St. Thomas identifies two features of a response of a passion. It says there's a movement of the sense appetite. All right. And then there's a bodily change. And when he talks about bodily changes, he's deeply indebted to the best biology of his time. And I'll think about it largely in terms of movements in the heart or around the heart. We have other ways by which to account for it. It doesn't necessarily say that St. Thomas was a bumpkin, but it's to say that we have more refined sciences whereby to specify the types of things that go on. But, you know, we recognize this. Like when you get angry, you know, you see red, your blood pumps a bit faster, your heart beats a bit faster. You can like feel the vascular dilation because your body is marshaling a corporeal change, a bodily change, so as to provoke a response. All right, because at some level you've registered a kind of injustice. You have been slighted. There's a situation that needs to be rectified, right? You need to visit a kind of vindication on it, sometimes rendered as vengeance. Like that all registers for you at a particular sense level. And so this bodily change accompanies the movement of the sense appetite, activated by whatever pertinent, you know, like thing that's going on, so as to propel you. Chesterton has this line in a poem called Lepanto, in which he describes the famous battle of 1571, during which a united Christian fleet defeated a Turkish fleet, which was kind of knocking at the door of Christendom's border. And he says of a particular Christian prince who was unmoved by the call to arms, dead is all the innocence of anger and surprise. And when I first read that line, I was like, what are you talking about? The innocence of anger. We typically don't think about anger as an innocent thing. But when we kind of zoom in on this bodily change, we bring into focus the fact that emotions are for a purpose, all right? They're for, in that case, the righting of a wrong. But in the case of love, the inclining to a good. Or in the case of sorrow, the registering of an evil or the registering of a pain, a suffering. So they all have their place within our human lives. And to the degree that they're formed by the virtues, right, they have a good place in our human lives, one by which we are upbuilt, right, by which we're saved. And so what the demons try to do is they try to get in and tinker in a way that distracts us, right? In a way that inflames our emotions such that they become more vehement and less subject to reason, such that we are cowed by fear or otherwise crazed by desire. And because they have access to the physical, right? They have access to our emotions because, like we said, emotions are just an activation of the sense appetite or a movement of the sense appetite with a corporeal change. So the demons have some access to that insofar as they can exercise their power upon our bodies and the kind of manifold which our bodies act through. So then passing on to the psychological, you know, you can think about the psychological in terms of brain chemistry as an underlying constituent factor. And we've already talked about the way in which the demons have access to bodily movements. But then obviously, psychologically speaking, there's the apparatus of conceptual thought, all right, which in our case seems to be largely image-driven. So Father James made reference to the common sense, and after coordinating sense experience, we use that phantasm, as it were, as an instrument through which the light of the mind draws forth from the other component part of the intellect. That's to speak in crass terms, but from the possible intellect, an intelligible species. All right, so our experience of reality, coordinated, right, and then deployed as an instrument, is what we use, or what our intellects use, to gain purchase on reality. All right, not to control it, not to manipulate it, but to experience it in all its fullness. All right, so the demons, their typical approach to your psychological life would be by way of proposing images. All right, and I think a lot of people will envision this in terms of invasive thoughts. Okay, so you'll not be shocked to hear, and maybe you'll be somewhat comforted to hear, that a lot of people will confess to having blasphemous images that populate their minds early on in their conversion. Right? They'll see holy things in terrible situations, or holy things associated closely with ugly things, right? Sacred things with profane things. And they'll think that that represents a kind of deficiency in them, like their past life coming back to haunt them. All right? There might be parts of your experience which contribute to that. But sometimes it can be simple to simply say, it can be sufficient to simply say, yeah, that's from elsewhere. All right. You set that aside, or you flee that thought, or you change the scenery, or you engage in some activity which just directs you elsewhere. Okay. So with respect to physical, they can make manifest, perhaps by influencing your sensorium, perhaps by manipulating other elements at play. With respect to emotions, right, we have these two dimensions of bodily change, movement of the sense appetite, to which they have access by virtue of their embodied nature. So you might find yourself stirred up, or you might find yourself, in oldie-timey speech, in a brown study, you know, like in a terrible mood for which you cannot account. All right. And then with respect to the psychological, you know, some access, it seems, to brain chemistry, and then some access to conceptual thought by mode of images proposed. Okay. So these would be... Is this an exhaustive list of the ways in which demons can influence our life, our embodied lives? No, right? But this kind of gives you a rough sketch. So that way you can be aware of the ways in which, and then sensitize to what that means, okay? But then we end with the spiritual, all right? We end with the spiritual. And here I'm thinking especially of our spiritual powers of intellect and will, which, while they use the body, right, they are not circumscribed by the body, if you're familiar with that word, or they're not limited by the body, right? They, in a certain sense, transcend the body. All right, so there might be a genetic defect which makes it difficult for an individual to exercise intellect and will, but that doesn't represent a deficiency in the intellect, okay? That represents a deficiency in its expression. So you have spiritual powers of intellect and will which transcend corporeal organs, all right? And which give rise to activities which are themselves immaterial, which is one of the ways in which the ancient tradition proves the immortality and thus the immateriality and thus the immortality of the soul. Okay? Now, the only one who has access to this directly and intimately is God. All right? As its creator. And there's this famous Augustinian teaching that God is more intimate to us than we are to ourselves. God is more interior to us than we are to ourselves. Father James introduced me to the Sisters of Life right after I was ordained. And we went up to their convent in Toronto, Ontario. And I remember listening to one of the sisters give a talk, and she used the image that many of us have encountered of Christ knocking at the door. There's a famous pre-Raphaelite painter, William Holman Hunt, who has this image of Christ crowned in thorns knocking at the door, the implication being that we are meant to admit him to our interior life. And she kind of turned the image on its head. And she said, it's more true to say that it's we who are knocking at the door of our hearts to be admitted therein by Christ, which is cool. It's beautiful to think about it in those terms. It's more appropriate to think of ourselves as alienated from ourselves, right? Than as God is somehow standing outside. All right. God is more interior to us than we are to ourselves. And as the creator of our nature, right, as the giver of our nature, God can act interior to our human nature in a way that's strong and sweet, All right? In a way that's profoundly natural. Even more natural than our own natural movement. All right? That means to say when God acts interior to us, it's not violent. He doesn't force our hand. All right? That should influence the way in which you think about your vocation. If you ever thought like, okay, God needs priests because he doesn't have enough of them. I find the thought of being a priest utterly distasteful, but its difficulty probably signals an invitation because clearly God wants me to do those things which lie most contrary to my inclination because this life is about overcoming difficulties, right? Not really. No. I mean, there's parts of all of those steps which are kind of true, but at the end of the day, God created you because he thought you might like it. All right? Not for purposes of crass indulgence, for purposes of his glory. But he doesn't need you. Like Father James stressed, he could do it all immediately. He rejoices to do it immediately, because he wants to implicate you in his plans. Because he wants his divine life to course through your veins. He wants his divine life to pass through your agency. All right? So, that's another consideration entirely. All right, so God has innermost access to your interior life. And he builds about your interior life a bulwark, right? A parapet. You are a city walled round by the care, by the solicitude, by the love of your creator and redeemer. And he does not permit you to be tried beyond your strength. He does not permit you to be overcome by enemy assailants. God abides with you in your interior life as a bastion, as a vindicator. All right. So within this setting, then, what can you do? Father James shared a phrase with me, which I like a lot. He says, talk to heaven, not to hell. Talk to heaven, not to hell. In general, we fix our eyes on the Most High God, on his warrior angels, on his saints, on those who have promised to avail us of their help, whether by way of direct intervention or intercession. And then recognize that you have a certain baptismal authority and that you can chase from your life those things which are not of God. All right, so a typical way by which to do so would be like a cleansing prayer. All right, and Father James, again, he made mention of a potential handout, you know, but there are good resources for this type of thing that you probably shouldn't just kind of figure out on the dark internet, but the type of thing that you should do in relationship, you know, so do with a trusted spiritual director, somebody on whom you can rely to mediate the tradition in balanced fashion, right? And then to furnish you with the goods that are going to keep you safe. All right. So like a typical cleansing prayer would be like, Lord Jesus Christ, I cover myself in your most precious blood. All right. So you call on the blood of Jesus. And I bind and send at the foot of the cross the spirit of anxiety, that you may do with it there what you will. You don't do anything with it. You just bind it and send it, that Christ might do with it what he wills. All right, so that's a baptismal authority, which lays claim to Christ's precious blood, which names the thing by which you are currently vexed, all right, and that sends it to him. It doesn't do anything with, just sends it to him. All right, so refers it to his ultimate authority. Or the spirit of insomnia, or the spirit of whatever else, you know. There are various things which come up in our life which we can lay claim to Christ's cleansing blood within the setting of our baptismal authority to treat as such. Okay, so like what particular things then should you deal with in this way? All right, so like kind of how should you think about your experience of opposition or your experience of attack? So there are three traditionally identified sources of opposition or of attack: the world, the flesh, and the devil. All right, the world, the flesh, and the devil. You've come across this before, you've heard this before, it's no surprise. St. Thomas will say in one setting that even had the evil one not fallen, it would still have been possible for us to fall. Because why? Well, treat it first in its principles. We still have an ambivalent will. Right? We're still not at our creation, in a state of beatitude, thereby bound by God, who is himself universally true and universally good. And so we're going to be able to see whatever limited or particular goods that we encounter under this light or under that light, under which light we might affirm or deny. Okay? So we'll never be so overwhelmed by the proposition of to, you know, being from God and for God in the way that God wills, as to have no other option because of the way in which our will is structured, the way in which our nature is furnished. All right, so even without the devil proposing, prompting, goading, whatever, right, there's still the possibility of defection. And I think that informs our praxis. I don't think we need be overly concerned as to the source of opposition or to the source of mischief. It could be the world. It could be the flesh. It could be the devil. All right? A typical approach would just be to treat it in kind of simplest terms. I've encountered this before. This was typically prompted by an experience of something that I found tempting, right? I have an ad blocker on my internet browser, but there are certain websites that have workarounds. And whenever I scroll to the bottom of this webpage, I see images which cause me to be excited or to be tempted or to be saddened or to be whatever else. All right? So I know that that's happened before. I'm experiencing that temptation now. So it's probably just a flesh kind of thing. Lord Jesus Christ, yeah, grant me the grace to get over it. All right? So, you know, you have some kind of inferential modicum of certainty as to the source thereof, but it's not too terribly important, right? Because you just refer it to Christ, to whom you're going to refer all of these things, right? Or if, yeah, let's say that you're in a situation where you're in San Francisco and it's June and you didn't know what the social events calendar for the city held. And here we are, you know, and you're like trying to sidestep, avoid, and, you know, sally your way in another direction. But like you feel this profound sadness kind of wash over you, right? And you're like, oh, right? That might have natural explanation. It might have preternatural explanation, right? Because often wise people and exorcists will testify that the demons kind of get in to spiritual wounds. They lodge in spiritual wounds when people dabble in the occult, when people are fixed in unforgiveness, and when people commit certain kinds of sexual sins. You know, so like those would be, that's not to say that those are the only things, but those are often things associated with demonic mischief. And when you find yourself in a certain situation where it seems like that's a live option and a sadness, a deep sadness washes over you somewhat inexplicably, then you might just be prompted in that moment to say, Lord Jesus Christ, I cover myself in your most precious blood. And I bind and send to the foot of the cross the spirit of despair, the spirit of discouragement, the spirit of sadness, that you might do with it there what you will. All right? And then change the scene. So I think that regardless of the source from which, it's not terribly important for us to sort it out, right? Because often enough, trying to sort it out will engage you in patterns of thought which involve you with the thing itself. And typically, we don't want to be involved with the thing itself. All right. There are certain temptations that you do have to confront. Okay, like a temptation to resentment, right? So you know you've tried to forgive this person, but every once in a while when you cross paths, you start ideating about how you're going to tell him off or how you're going to prove him wrong or how you're going to embarrass him in the presence of your enemies. Right? Those thoughts need to be checked. Right? Lord, this is not of you. I retreat from this thought. I claim the forgiveness that I have chosen, and I ask you for a double portion therein. All right? But a lot of temptations just need to be flown. Sexual temptations are the classic example, but invasive thoughts of whatever sort, they're not typically going to be engaged fruitfully with. It's like, what are you gonna, are you gonna do that? Right? So like, say you're sitting at your computer and you experience a wave of sexual temptation, but this essay has to get done. All right? So you're kind of working between two major premises. You know, like academic efficiency is a good to be pursued. You know, sexual temptation is an evil to be flown. And then the question is, what minor premise are you going to operate under? You know, like, because if you convince yourself that I'm just going to stick to efficiency, this is probably going to linger. All right? And it probably won't lessen unless this task proves more delightful and more absorbing. The chances of it, though, if you're like on page 3 of 17, you know, like comparing Hobbes to Locke on some obscure point, are low. So that would probably be an invitation to get up and to take a walk, right? Something simple, not something drastic. You don't have to take like 8 cold showers and walk over like 16 beds of hot coals, but it's probably typically not to be reasoned with, okay? So where did it come from? In that setting, I don't think it's too terribly important, right? You call on the Lord, you change the scene, you treat it as the spiritual tradition has counseled us to treat it for 2,000 years. So I think there are kind of two extremes to avoid. Don't banalize and don't hyper preternaturalize. Okay, don't banalize in the sense like everything has a naturalistic explanation and it's just a matter of adjusting the material conditions. That's probably not the case, all right? We believe, you know, we're baptized persons, we believe, and so we operate out of that belief. But then on the other hand, don't hyper preternaturalize. It's not necessarily the case that everything is kind of visited upon us by demons. Because if we begin to think along those lines, then, well, you've just seen how this goes. Just look at the internet. So how then can we be confident? Because I think that this is like the most basic point to be derived therefrom. We read in St. Paul's letter to the Romans, God makes all things work to the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Okay, God makes all things work to the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. This is my mother's favorite verse of scripture. So that for us means concretely that we advert consciously, we advert deliberately to God who is good, to God who is provident. This is something that Father James talks a lot about in the Father's House Retreat and in the book, right? God reveals himself as Father. I mean, Christ comes to reveal his Father as Father. There's like 11 references in the Old Testament to God's kind of paternal care of his people in those explicit terms. And you think Old Testament, like Ignatius Study Bible, it's like 1,000 pages. All right, New Testament, that's like 230 pages, something like that. In the Gospel of John alone, he's referred to his Father something like 121 times. Christ came to reveal the Father, all right? Concretely, intensely, intimately, as a way by which of communicating to you God's care, God's providence, God's solicitude, right? God's love. So that's a very concrete and operable principle in our lives. We have a God who reveals himself as Father, who loves us and who provides for us. All right? He provides for us with good angels. All right? Our angel guardians look on the face of God day and night, and they look to our betterment, they look to our care day and night. But God's providence also involves demons, right? God will use even their mischief for the trying of the just, and as Father James adverted to, for the punishing of the unjust. This is, in fact, part of their torture. This is part of their punishment, is that they recognize that despite their best efforts, they will be deployed within the setting of God's providence. I'd commend to you the reading of the second parable in Matthew chapter 13, parable of the wheat and the tares, and think about it in terms of providence. Nothing falls outside the bounds of the field. The evil, which is visited upon, is done with the master's knowledge. He doesn't say, it looks like an enemy's done this. He just says, an enemy's done this. He knows. All right? And the text reads, at the time when men sleep, it doesn't say that the master sleeps, because he who watches over Israel slumbers not nor sleeps. All right? So it happens by his permission, but he makes it redound to our good. It might seem strange. Why would you let wheat and tares grow up together? Right? Why not just weed them out now? They might visit a little bit of damage on the wheat, but you'd have a cleaner field, right? St. Augustine, when he reads that passage, he says, such is the mercy of God that it can make tares wheat. All right? God's love, God's providence is so rich that it can take even things which we would despair of as beyond repair, as lost and gone forever, and claim them back. Demons, as we've already heard, are irreformable in their choice because they're not going to get new information, right? They're not going to get new input. But God can use even their mischief for the trying of the just and the punishing of the unjust. So what this is going to do is it's going to challenge our notion of what it means for us to flourish. Okay? Because I think we are often tempted by, untrue or partially true versions of human flourishing. Physical integrity. It is nice, but it is not everything. Let's say that you suffered a sports injury your senior year of college, all right? And you're thinking about the rest of your life. Sports was such an integral part, and you have difficulty imagining what it's going to be like after that. It'll be all right. You might be sad. You might be super moody, all right? Because the exercise on which you formerly relied is no longer the exercise for you. But you'll be all right. Physical integrity. It's good. It's not everything. All right. Emotional balance. All right. We talk a lot, and justly so, about mental health, right, and about self-care in these terms. And it's great. I think that like the destigmatization of You know, therapy and counseling has been super fruitful, and especially post-pandemic, as many young people struggle with these problems. It's to be taken, you know, it's a bull to be taken by its horns. But also know that if you experience that, you don't have to simply rest in the destigmatization and realize I'm not unnormal or I'm not weird, right? That's also, it's not the last word to be pronounced over you. The Lord, when he comes in his glory, is not going to say, yes, you have balanced emotions, you know? He has further things to say besides. He has better things to say besides, you know? So you might have difficulty with it here or later. Regardless, it's not the last thing to be spoken over you. It's part of your story. It's not the whole of your story, okay? But what does ultimately matter is your spiritual life. And that involves a physical element. It involves an emotional element. It involves a psychological element. But what it ultimately entails is Christ's choice for you and your choice for him. And it might look like a dumpster fire, like 95% of the time. You might be just an endless series of resolutions and broken resolutions, right? But if sufficiently Christ-haunted as to continually return to the source of his mercy, then he'll use that. He will. He'll use that. So while the demons might have access to you physically and emotionally and psychologically, they don't have access to you spiritually, which at the end of the day is just about all that matters. So like you can think about simple Christian practices which can communicate this to us in powerful fashion, like a morning offering. You can give your day to Jesus, which is pretty wild. You can like give him your whole day. You might think like, yeah, I mean, regardless of whether I do it consciously or unconsciously, it's his. I mean, he's going to take it from me. He's taking everything else. but you can make of it an offering. And I think that this is the most essential point. You will suffer. There is no way to escape that. Your life will be characterized by heaping helpings of pain and suffering. Cheers. All right. Eat up. All right. But it need not be wrested from your grasp. You need not cling anxiously to your life for fear that someone will take it from you, for fear that someone will change it for the worse. It is going to be taken from you. It is going to be changed in certain instances for the worst. But you have the choice to offer it. You can give it. I was talking to a handful of women who have sons who are in religious life. So like mothers of friars. And I was just trying to communicate this point in simple terms. It's like, yeah, people are going to tell you that you haven't lost your son, that you've gained a whole community. It's like, you've lost your son. He's gone. So you need to know that. All right? Brutal point, but it's the most merciful thing that can be said to you. Because now you have the choice of whether or not you want to give him. Because if you don't think that you've lost your son, you're going to try to hold on to your son. And then you're going to find yourself straining against your son. And you're going to wonder if you can ever have union with your son. All right? That's terrible. But if you concede the fact that you've lost your son, right, then you can give your son. And in that offering, you can be with your son. Because you offer him to the same God to whom he offers himself. And in the same trajectory with which he offers himself. All right? And then you can look on, you know, St. Augustine and St. Monica and see something of your own story. Right? Your life is going to be taken from you. You're going to get older. You're going to get uglier. You're going to get tireder. You're going to get weaker, right? Everything's just going to come to pieces downstream of 28 years old. All right. So cheers. You got that to look forward to too. Fill up your plate and feast. All right. But you can give it. All right. You can give it. So at the end of the day, final thought, there is no secret key. There is no secret key. All right. But the good news is that while Christian life typically isn't easy, it need not be complicated, all right? We need not complicate it with like inordinate curiosity about demons or inordinate solicitude for things of an inessential nature or inordinate anxiety about how we're going to rectify the physical or the emotional or the psychological dimensions. You have to lose your life to save it. That's not to say that we don't care about those things. We pay them a proportionate attention, but all under the understanding that what matters is Christ's choice for me and my choice for him. However imperfect my choice might be at present, I have certainty and confidence that he who has begun a good work in me will see it to completion, and that I need only consent to and cooperate with the grace that he is actually giving. So then we can return to God, our provident source, right, our loving source, in fidelity. Because he's promised. And he always comes through on his promises. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.